Hello, listener. It's me, Joe Devine from the Movies You Forgot podcast. Just here ahead of today's episode with a little editor's note to let you know that next week there won't be a new episode releasing. We're taking a break week so that we can catch up with our recording and editing schedule. It's been a bit busy recently. But the week after that, we'll be back with the film we choose at the end of today's episode. But anyway, hope you enjoy today's episode and see you again in a couple of weeks.
Hey, Joe, remember that we did The Artist a couple of episodes back?
Yeah.
Do you remember that? We did a show about The Artist.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And you had some rather strong words to say. When we were talking about gimmicks, you were heard to remark rather unfavorably about the film A Ghost Story by...
By Instagram.com, by James Franco.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just interesting that it's obviously deep burned in your mind, your anti A Ghost Story thing. And I just had some correspondence from two people about your thoughts. And well, particularly,
who are they? Is one of them James Franco?
You know, the director of A Ghost Story directed The Green Knight, one of your fave films.
Yeah. I didn't know that, but yeah, sure.
So, I mean, I don't know, just... You keep saying, I don't know why you're saying James Franco, because he's
isn't
not in
James
the film.
Franco in The Ghost Story? I can't remember. It's something about him, isn't it?
No, it's Casey Affleck.
Casey Affleck, whatever. James Franco, Casey Affleck, they're all the same to me.
Right. No, I mean, those two are quite different. But I had a personal message and also a message on my Letterboxd. Patrick Gamble said, Adam, can you ask Joe why he was giving A Ghost Story shit for using the Academy ratio, what he called the Instagram box, but for some reason gave this film, The Artist, as a pass for doing the same thing? Bit gimmicky, no? And also, no, wait, before the rebuttal,
listen,
Tim...
If your personal correspondence is from Horror Tim, then I am not interested, okay? Tell Tim I don't care what he has to say.
No, listen, I care what Tim has to say.
All right, come on, Tim. What is it? What is it, Tim?
Horror Tim says, and this is a message, it's in quotes, "This is shot like Instagram," says a film podcaster about a film that is wider than it is tall and is exactly the same aspect ratio as the French homage to silent cinema he just spent the best part of an hour defending. Absolutely pulling the pants down. I don't know what film podcaster he's talking about. That's just a message he's just sent into the void. I've reached out there and I've clutched it close to my heart.
Yeah. So, well, guess what? No surprise that Horror Tim likes A Ghost Story, huh?
Well, what have you got to say to Patrick Gamble? He's also noticed the same thing.
Listen, guys, okay? There's a difference. One of them's black and white. One of them's supposed to be square. One of them's made during a time, I mean, it wasn't made during the time, but it's made reminiscing a time when it was all square, everything was square. That's actually not true, because back in the very olden days when they were making silent films, you could only watch them at the cinema, and they were widescreen, weren't they?
They were.
Whereas what I'm talking about is really a middle period of television when the TVs were square.
But you were using the Instagram thing as a stick to beat A Ghost Story with.
Yeah.
And that you weren't... I mean, I didn't give a shit about the aspect ratio of either.
But it's the reason for the choice, isn't it? That's the thing. Like, my pants aren't down. My pants are fully up with three belts on, because they can't be pulled down. Hold on.
Okay, yeah.
The reason it's different, okay, is because one of them is a stylistic choice that makes complete sense in concert with the film. The other is a thing that they've just done for fun because they think it's cool and will set them apart from other films. Those are two completely different contexts, okay? And I won't have it from neither Robert Gamble or Horror Tim.
That's assuming no knowledge of A Ghost Story or David Lowery's decision to film it like that.
Sure.
You just think, oh, he's just done it for a laugh.
Yeah, I do.
Right, but he might have had deep... aesthetic reasons for it.
Let's find out why. What's his name? David Lowery.
David Lowery.
Here's what Colin says. Ready?
Yeah.
David Lowery shot A Ghost Story in a 1.33:1 aspect ratio, basically an old TV square with rounded corners, because he wanted it to feel intimate, trapped, and a little old-fashioned, like looking through a small window or a faded photograph. The boxy frame reinforces the movie's themes of confinement, memory, and nostalgia. It's about the ghost being stuck, and the frame literally closes in the space.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the least of that film's problems.
What do you want me to say? You want me to say that my pants are down? That my bum's out? Is that what you want me to say? Yes,
I do, please.
Sex organ, genitals and genitalia are hanging loose and blowing in the wind? Is that what you want me to say? Because
yes,
they're not. They're covered up. They're covered up with woolen undercloth. And then I've got a loincloth over the top of that, and I'm wearing a sort of a ballet stole. Mm. And also I've got like knee-high wellies on, so no one's getting anywhere near me shins.
That's
and
the
reason is because I've made a reasonable point, a very reasonable point. The only problem is that I've done it in a context, in a fashion, which has allowed people to come at me and accuse me of something that seems on the face of it, seems absurdly wrong, you know? But it only seems that way. And as soon as you dig a little deeper...
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host. And Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
Hi, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast, the show in which me, your host,
hi.
Adam Richmond, hi. Yeah, the show in which me, your host Adam Richmond, and my pal, we talk about the movies we'd forgot we'd even seen in the first place. But who is this pal? Who is this guy, this pristine guy who never gets anything wrong?
Fully clothed.
He's got his pants on. His name is Mr. Joe Devine.
That's right. And I am covered up on the bottom.
On today's episode, we are doing the 2019 Greta Gerwig-directed flick based on the book of the same name. Not called.
Oh, God.
We're doing it on today's episode. We're doing the 2019 Greta Gerwig directed flick.
You've started again.
Based on the book of the same name.
Yeah, play it through.
It's not called.
What would it not be called in this instance?
It's not called.
Based on the same name.
Based on the same name. It's not called that. It's called Little Women.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's not called the 2019 Greta Gerwig directed. Yeah. It's not called 2019 Greta Gerwig directed. Greta Gerwig directed.
No one's ever got in their own head more.
Well, I think you got in your head when you were trying to defend yourself against...
No, I've got
Michael
pants on!
It's of course Little Women. Of course it's Little Women.
Of course.
It's 135 mins, this iteration. It's based on the book written by Louise May Alcott.
Louisa. Yeah.
Doesn't say that in the letterbox. Louisa.
I guess it's based on like a couple of books.
Oh, is it? Is it based on a couple of books?
Yeah, because the events of the book Little Women, I don't believe, I might be wrong, but I don't believe that where that book ends is where this film ends. I think some of this story comes in the following book.
Oh, yeah, you'd like to think, wouldn't you? the things that Gerwig does with this film.
Well, no, there's that as well. Some things aren't in any of the source material.
Gerwig will not be hidebound by the original source material.
Well,
she will break free.
Nor should she include other things. Yeah.
Because she is an artist and she does more. She won't just adapt the fucking book Little Women. She's got bigger fish to fry.
You're absolutely right. And I'm going to interject here to say, even though it seems as though Adam's doing a big joke, he actually means what he says. And we'll come on to explain why that's true during this episode.
Okay, just in case anyone wasn't clear, I love this film. I thought it was fantastic. But Joe had to interject and spoil the fun.
It sounded a lot like he was saying, oh, woman makes a movie and then she's got to change it, hasn't she? She's got to get involved. So I just wanted to make it clear that that's not what you actually meant the things you were saying, even if you did sound deeply cynical when you were saying them.
That's what you heard.
Yeah.
I think is there's three layers to my irony.
Yep.
There's me.
Yep.
And then there's the version of the man who's saying, oh, like women, a woman can't even just adapt a book normally. normally. And then there's the version of me above that who's actually making fun of both that guy and then the bottom guy. So I'm like the top guy.
It's very complex.
Yeah. And if people don't get that, that means that they're the bottom guy or the middle guy.
Or the middle woman.
Women don't listen to this show.
That's true. That is true. But I wanted to caveat this, Adam, by just letting you know that my wife is going to listen to this episode because she loves Little Women. And we talked about it a lot in the lead up. So if you notice me being in any way different or a little bit more conservative,
apologetic,
it's because my wife is listening. Okay?
Okay. So we're listening to Cuck Joe. Oh, man. I'm going to go. I'm Rogan.
Oh, no.
I'm full Rogan Richmond today. Okay. I'm going Rogan.
Well, that's good because if I'm Cuck Joe, then you have a little bit more license to extend. And then we'll balance each other out, you know? But no, of course, I'm not saying that. I'm not Cuck Joe. My wife wouldn't enforce anything on me. She wants to hear what I have to say. All I'm saying is that I might just, you know, she doesn't normally listen. And so I'm nervous in a way that I wouldn't normally be nervous because she's going to listen to what I say here. All it is that she loves Little Women. And I want to do a justice to that love. And also, you know, I just want to. I'm just going to hit the bat straight down the middle.
Okay. Well, yeah. I want to thwart that attempt. I'm going to thwart that every turn.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's what I'm going to try and do.
Yeah.
If we're going to play wives, if we're going to play the wives card, mm-hmm. I've got a wife. My wife loves Little Women as well, and she's seen all three versions of Little Women.
Right, there's four. You know? So, I mean, she sounds...
Well, she's seen all three of them.
Right.
So,
well, that's
exactly the kind of thing that a man would say. I think you'll find her there's four. Oh, thank you, Mr. Man. Thank you for mansplaining me how many movies there are
about Little
Women.
This has got off to an awful start. At the end of last week's episode, we're saying like, oh, we've got a terrible track record of picking films with women. And we're like, and then immediately.
This is the best start ever.
No, okay. God, no.
Right.
This is horrendous.
It's normal.
I'm so prepared for today. I'm going to engage with this film in such a serious way. You aren't going to believe what you're hearing. I've read an essay.
This is The Letterbox. Of course, Gerwig wrote it. Own your story. Four sisters come of age in America in the aftermath of the Civil War. That's it. No years. You just have to know when the Civil War is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think
it's in the 1800s.
Well, something like that. And of course, let's talk about the sisters. Let's talk about these three little women. We've got Jo March, played by Saoirse Ronan.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Meg March, played by Emma Watson, a.k.a. Hermione.
Oh, dear.
From Harry Potter. We've got Amy March, played by Florence Pugh. And we've got Beth March, played by Eliza Scanlon.
Yes.
Laura Dern plays Marmy March. And of course, we can't forget Timothée Chalamet as their beloved neighbour Laurie.
Sure.
We'll sort of say the sisters, the March sisters, fall into certain types. Okay, so Jo, should we talk about the actresses or their name or the character names?
I'm going to say Jo a lot in this episode instead of Saoirse.
Great.
But I might, and I'm probably going to say Emma Watson.
Great, okay.
I'm also going to say Florence Pugh, but I'm going to say Beth Marsh, you know?
Okay, so Jo and Beth, they get character names.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But Meg and Amy, they get
actor names for two very different reasons.
Fair dues.
And Timothée Chalamet, I'm only going to say Timothée Chalamet.
Absolutely. Okay. So Jo is the writer of the bunch. She's got bigger ideas than what society wants of her to marry, etc. She's that kind of classic Jane Austen type character. You know.
She's the protagonist.
She's also the protagonist. Meg, she is, how would you describe Meg? She's
the oldest sister. She's the dutiful older sister.
Who had big dreams of, say, marrying money, but then really she marries for love,
mm-hmm.
And is sort of semi-punished for that.
Mm-hmm.
Amy is the...
Youngest.
Oh, yeah, she's the youngest. It's confusing in this movie because Florence Pugh plays her young and old.
Sure.
She's the youngest. She's petulant. But she can draw.
Mm.
So,
yep.
You know, take that. That's a combo, isn't it? That's a three-dimensional female character.
Absolutely.
Petulant, but can draw.
That's right.
And Beth is the one who ill. Is going to die.
Yeah, Beth is the ill one.
Ill one.
Yes, that's right. She's the sick one, isn't she? The sick one that dies. And perhaps it comes across economically in this Greta Gerwig version. It definitely comes across more in the book, though, that she's also the representation of what women are expected to be at the time that this book is being written. Yeah. She's very kind and nice and quiet and musical and, you know, sort of polite. And also she cares for the poor sick family, and that's how she gets sick and eventually dies. So there's sort of a lot going on there as well, but ultimately ends on her death.
Yeah, you know, don't do nice things.
Yep.
I saw this 2 years ago. Was it 2 years? It came out at Christmas. It was the Christmas movie.
Yes.
Very... Maybe was it even 3 years? Oh, I don't know why I'm guessing. It's 2019. It wasn't 2 years ago.
It was 6 years ago.
It was
ago.
Fucking... Oh, gee. I saw this at Christmas 6 years ago.
Oh, you went to the cinema to see it?
Went to the cinema to see this.
Right, yeah.
Me and my wife were at my wife's parents for Christmas, and we saw it on Boxing Day, obviously, because my wife loves the Little Women, all of them.
Uh-huh.
So we went to see it, and I'd not seen the Winona Ryder version, never read the book because I'm into Elroy and crime. I've never read a Jane Austen, and I really need to sort that out. If you look at my bookshelves,
yeah,
it's man after man after man.
Right.
You've got Atwood at the beginning.
Okay.
There's one woman. Highsmith in the middle.
Yeah.
And then at the back, you've got a Virginia Woolf that I might have just started but not really got into.
Right,
It's appalling. Of course, there's some Ursula Le Guin. Of course, some Ursula Le Guin.
Yeah.
But I do need to get into my Austens. I thought it was fantastic. The only familiarity I had with the source material is that there's a joke in one of the Friends episodes where Joey gets into reading and reading Little Women.
Yeah.
And that's it. The references in that silly sitcom are what I know. And so then it was a real treat to go and see it in 2019, and then I completely forgot it. What about you? Did you see it at the cinema?
I didn't see it at the cinema, no. My wife went with her sisters because she has three sisters, and there's four sisters in the film, you know. I think that's a big deal for them. I didn't go. I watched it for the first time probably 2 years ago around Christmas. It was one of my wife's choices. I'd never seen a Little Women before. I hadn't seen the 1994 version or indeed any of the older ones, and I'd never read the book. So it was, for me, my experience was interesting because I came in the same way as you did. I came to the Greta Gerwig version first. And then a couple of days later, I thought, oh God, let's watch the 1994 version because I really enjoyed it. And I was really bored by the 94 version, partly because it happens in chronological order and it just feels
so
like a
boring.
Completely different story, like a completely different film. The interpretations of the characters are really different. So it was fun to watch it again a second time because I feel as though I am better placed now to understand where Greta Gerwig has evolved it from what she's evolved it. Some of that's very interesting. But like you, I think it's, I don't think it's an excellent film. I think it's a good film with some excellent scenes, and it does something very strange to me when I watch it. I don't like it at the beginning. It very slowly wins me over. I get a bit more annoyed towards the end, and then it wins me over again by the end. And the exact same pattern occurred the first time I watched it too. So I think I think the film has some flaws, but I think they're all flaws that, upon a little bit of reading, are completely understandable, probably completely unavoidable, and the creative pursuit that has led to them happening is great. So I'm sort of on board with the whole thing, but I don't think the film is excellent. I just think it's very good.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, please.
Given your knowledge of the source material,
yes.
A key theme in Gerwig's version of Little Women is the question of economic status and the economic status of women, and how important that is, and it keeps recurring in the film.
Yes,
is that quite a central theme in the books?
Not as overtly, no.
Yeah, because I think that's what's so great about this version, or that's what struck me, is how the economic question, the economic status of each of the sisters plays out in each of their stories, and how important that is. So for Amy, the Florence Pugh sister, she gets to go to Paris to paint and she wants to marry, and she wants to marry well. And then Timothée Chalamet sniffing around her and wooing her. He's talking about love. But, you know, she's talking about, this is important, you know, money's important. I've got to look after my sisters. Joe wants to be a writer. Beth's going to die. And, you know, my older ones, the elder sisters married a penniless teacher. So there are all these economic questions that she's got, considerations that she has to take into account. So yeah, it's quite interesting. And I really liked how that ran through the movie, and it felt very progressive, but not in a overly modern, in your face sort of way.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth saying, that obviously those are the storylines that are from the book and from the other films. It's not, I think the thing with this film is that it brings that to the surface in a way that is much more overt. I agree with you to a certain extent that I don't think it's ever hammily done or done in a ham-fisted way. There is, of course, the sort of Oscar clip scene. I don't know if you can guess from the film which scene that was.
Is it the one where it's she's drawing and Chalamet comes in?
That's the scene, yeah. And she's talking to Timothée Chalamet, who at this point to her is maybe a bit of a love interest, but prior to this part of the story, Timothée Chalamet's character, Laurie, has actually already proposed to her older sister, Jo, and has been turned down. And there's you know, very confusing relationship dynamics here. But now she's older, she's in Paris, she's painting, he's there, and she's sort of courting the attention of this very wealthy British man and hoping to marry him. And Timothée Chalamet, little fucker, he questions her ethics involved. He sort of questions her judgment here, her value, or her value judgments. And she gives this great speech where she's walking towards the camera and walking towards him, and she's explaining that whilst for men, marriage might not be an economic proposition, for women it very much is, for all of these reasons. And it puts a sort of fine point on the undercurrent, the subtext that you're describing from the film. It dots the I's, it crosses the T's. It does it in a way that's like maybe 10% showier than I want it to be. Because yeah. I think like this was already really clear to me. And like you, I was enjoying this element of it. It's doing it in a way that's quite gentle and isn't sort of like hitting me around the head with it. And then there's just a very light slap on the face that I'm going, yeah, guys, I get it. This is the best bit of the film. Like, don't say it aloud. Don't. You'll break the spell if you do this.
Yeah, that's a fair criticism. I think it's a Hollywood movie, and so they need to spell it out. And then also, it's a trailer scene. You could plop that in a trailer, and it very much spells out, but fairly well in a nicely acted scene.
It's a great scene.
Well, let's talk about Pew. Pew plays the youngest sister.
Yes.
In the same way that we talked about Dunkirk's structure a bit too late. Well, maybe we're talking about the structure of Little Women too late.
Uh-huh.
The way that Gerwig tells us this tale is she starts in when the sisters have grown up. In their, what, mid-20s or something?
Yes.
Early 20s?
She starts just before the end.
Just before the end. Sets out where we'll come back to. And then wonderfully, she cuts back to when they're younger.
Mm-hmm.
And then she cuts between these two timelines. I think it's a beautifully structured film and screenplay.
It allows for some magnificent scenes.
Yeah. And we'll talk about the middle and the midpoint very soon. What Gerwig has decided to do is to have Pew play a 12-year-old, because
mm-hmm.
Amy's 12 or 13. She's very young.
Sure.
And then she also then is, what, I don't know, 18?
Yeah, I think closer to an adult. I don't exactly know how old.
So this is, we'd not released our Atonement episode. We watched Atonement together and we discussed Atonement. And in that movie, Saoirse Ronan, she plays the young protagonist in that movie, who is 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And then it's 4 years later and they recast her as Romola Garai.
Yes, an adult woman.
As an adult woman.
Yes.
It's so discombobulating.
Yes.
Well,
of course, they do this in the 1994 version of Little Women as well.
But I think it works in that one because you've got Kirsten Dunst, who is such a child.
Yeah.
And superb actress. And then they age her up to Samantha Mathis.
Yeah.
So they kind of match.
Sure.
Gerwig's like, fuck this. I can have Pew, she can play 12 and she can play 18.
She can. She can.
Sort of. But
no, like, I know, but there's something funny about it, though. It's a bit like, I think I've told you this before, but when I watch the BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, my favourite thing about it is that the actors playing the sisters are clearly in their mid-30s, and they're running through fields like teenagers. I don't mind at all. I completely buy it. And I think Florence Pugh... plays 12 really well. It doesn't matter that she's obviously not 12 years old. It doesn't matter. We've all seen the film 4 times before. We've all read the book, whatever. Like, this is a deep, like, deep meta state reimagining of the thing.
Yeah.
I think you get away with these sorts of all you're asking someone to do is suspend their disbelief a little bit, and it doesn't bother my enjoyment of the film. Sometimes I forget she's 12. Sometimes I forget, and then I think, gosh, she's... Oh, and then I go, oh, yeah, she is a child. That's why she's, you know, burning someone's book, that sort of thing. I don't think it really matters.
No, it doesn't hugely matter. She does play that age and the temperament very well, but I do think it's problematic because the question of Laurie and Timothée Chalamet is that he's a grown man. He's 18 or something when he first meets Amy. When she's 12, and then he's going to start. Yeah. He does.
I think he's 16.
Whatever, 16.
Yeah.
And then he starts macking on her when she's older.
He's macking.
And
yeah.
He's macking. And it's like, oh, what now? Because she's wearing a corset. It's just a little bit. I don't know. It's just like.
Well no, just, of course. But then I think the structure of this episode is all over the place. But we simply can't go any further without talking a little bit about the book. I know you don't want book club, but we need to talk about Louisa May Alcott because I think it's crucial to understanding the very nature of the things you're grappling with now, Adam. Why would a Timothée Chalamet want to marry a spiteful little sister Amy? Why does Saoirse Ronan playing Jo Marsh want to marry the weird German professor that's not even in the film? It doesn't seem to make any sense, right? And that's because it doesn't. So let me tell you, Louisa May Alcott, she wrote the first book, Little Women, in, I don't know, 1800 and something. It was published, and it was a big surprise success. Do you know why it was a surprise, Adam?
It was by a woman?
Yeah, because it was for women and girls, and they didn't really think that any one of them wanted to read anything, or would they? I don't know why, you know? Because they're also always talking about getting them to read and having them... I don't know. Anyway, it's a stupid, stupid thing from history. But it was a big success. And in between that book being published and then the second one being published, Louisa May Alcott got all of this fan mail from women and girls, and readers generally, who really wanted to know, does Jo Marsh marry Laurie? Because the first thing that was published, and this is where I can't remember if it's the whole of Little Women, the first book, or if Little Women was published in two different, in two parts. The first thing that was published ended before the proposal. And so readers loved the story, but it felt a little bit like a radical version of an ordinary story. And the expectation is that Jo Marsh and Laurie are going to get together and get married. And what happens is the publisher, who's overblown by the number of copies that have been sold, says to Louisa May Alcott, you have to write a second one to this, but the only way we're agreeing to let you do this is if you have to marry the characters off. Because these stories, like, they have to be moralistic. They can't end with the women not being married. That was the
That's
rule.
What he says in the film, Joe.
Yeah, I know,
That's what he
I
says
know.
In the film.
That's what he says in the film, right? And that's this is where Gerwig starts off, to weave in off. Jo Marsh into Louisa May Alcott. So some of what you're watching Saoirse Ronan play in this film is not the character Jo Marsh. It's a sort of combination of Jo Marsh and of Louisa May Alcott, the author of the book. So she agrees to it. Because she wants to publish the fucking thing. But out of the one interpretation is that out of spite in the second book, as a kind of fuck you to the publishers who are forcing her to do this, because Louisa May Alcott herself never married, and Louisa May Alcott hated Little Women when she wrote it. She much preferred writing the weird, violent stories that are discussed at the beginning of this film as well. The Saoirse Ronan character is publishing all of these things that the German professor doesn't really like. In real life, she way preferred doing that, and she just wasn't making as much money from it. So one theory is that as a fuck you to the publisher, she had Jo Marsh, her heroine, her protagonist, married off to some random old fusty German professor, who in the book is way older and is such a prick, like who hates everything that she writes and is enforcing all of these morals on her. It doesn't make any sense. It's a total betrayal of what the character would do. And she has Laurie, who is the main love interest, the hero of the story, marry the younger sister who everybody hates, who's treated Jo March. Like, the worst possible ending is what she does. And the theory is it's sort of a fuck you joke to the publishers, which I love as an idea.
What a lad.
Jeez, it's so funny, like, what becomes of that then, that, like, these are the films that are remade over and over. It's there's so many levels and layers to that of women and men, of course, watching these film adaptations, reading the book over generations and over different eras, responding to it in different ways, getting both the, you know, enjoying, unironically enjoying that love story, also enjoying the element that these are sort of more radical, independent characters than existed. In some ways, I think one of the reasons it's such a success today is because it's one of the only books from the past that really encapsulates that sort of like double-sided coin. You know, when you listen to women talk about the choice of like having a career or having a family or these sorts of things, you know, like wanting to be independent and not be defined by love or by their husbands or by marriage, but also wanting to get married or wanting to experience love and dependency and also being in it, you know, all of that stuff. The book and the film sort of maybe intentionally, maybe not, sort of embody all of that because the author hated them. And I think that's crucial when you then come to think about why Timothy Chalamet ends up with Florence Pugh in the film. It's not because it was meant to be that way because of a story structure. It's because it's a fuck you to the publisher.
So yeah, she's written the fuck you, but then thickos love it.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy. The last bit of the history lesson here, Adam, is I read an essay about Little Women. It was written by Lisa Paul, who's a researcher, I think works at a university, I can't remember which one. Near the beginning, Lisa Paul refers to the obituary of Louisa May Alcott, which was published in a publication called Atalanta, which was a publication at the time in the 1800s, whenever she died, near the turn of the century. It was a publication for young women and girls, and it mostly like published little stories and instructionals on like how to be a good woman, whatever. And in the essay, she goes on to talk about why the publication that published this obituary was called that, and she talks about the myth of Atalanta and Hippomenes. Do you remember that one?
Hippomenes.
I don't know if that's how you say it. Hippomenes, maybe?
No, it doesn't. No, what's that?
Hippomenes. Anyway, it's a Greek myth, but Atalanta is a skilled and swift-footed huntress who challenges suitors to a foot race to win her hand in marriage. This is the myth, with the penalty of death for those who lose. And then Hippomenes, or Hippomenes, or whatever his name is, who's one of the suitors, recognizes that he can't win in a fair foot race with her. So he seeks help from Aphrodite, who provides him with 3 golden apples. And then during the race, he strategically drops the apples, which Atalanta is unable to resist picking up because they're gold, and I guess she's a woman. And he wins the race.
Right? Can I say, like, for a minute, I thought you were setting up like a kind of a video game esque escapade. So he was dropping like booster apples.
She sped up as she was eating them. No, they slowed her down because she was like, oh, what's this? It's gold and it's an apple. And then she stopped in the race to pick them up because she's a woman and she's easily distracted by gold.
So it's like a proto Mario Kart.
Absolutely. Except, right. Yeah, instead of you slip it sliding on a banana, you stop, your curiosity pauses you while you look at this apple. Anyway, she says the point of the myth really, when it was written however many thousands of years ago, was that although Atalanta loses the race, actually the losing of the race is her lesson. She learns to be happy that she lost, because she lost to her husband. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot in there about subjugation and about submissiveness and how you can learn to be happy as a woman with a, you know, under the arm of a man, right? You don't always have to be winning in a race. Yeah,
you haven't lost really, because come on,
because you've won the guy.
Yeah, you've got the guy,
and you've got the golden apples. You know, what more do you want?
Do you remember playing Kiss Chase in primary school?
I remember watching the other children play it.
I remember one of my core memories. I've got two. I had another sex memory that I was going to chat about, but it turns out it's going to be Kiss Chase I'm going to chat about. Right. I've got a core memory of mine is playing Kiss Chase in primary school. And I remember that the feeling of running away, but also pretending like you were running away. So you really wanted to be caught. And it was like trying to master the, I'm definitely trying to run away. I don't want to be kissed, but like also you want
to
be kissed.
To get
of course
balance.
You want to be kissed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's like, because if you don't commit to running away, then you're out of the game, mate. You can't do that. That's not Kiss Chase. You've got to try and run, but then you also need to be caught. Because if you're not caught, you're not kissed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, heaven. That like riding that line of speed. So yeah, that's what.
Well, the reason I like that memory.
I don't know what you got.
I really want to hear the other sex memory though. Bring that back. Bring that in later.
Oh, I could do it right now.
Sure, why
right
not? Give me the sex memory now.
My wife put on a, you know, boiler suits.
Like a sort of like prison garb.
Yeah, like you see
an all-in-one.
There's a zip on them.
Yeah,
you see kind of trendy women in all around sort of wearing them.
I've seen women.
I've seen women. It's a very cool outfit. You see them more and more these days.
Anyway, I actually pointed at a woman the other day and I said, that's a great, I said double denim. I pointed at her and I said, oh, double denim, pretty cool. And she said, it's an all-in-one. I said, oh, single denim.
Single denim, single doesn't denim. Count. So my wife's got this this kind of boiler suit thing. She puts it on, she zips it up and she's very proud. And I immediately went, oh, yes, please. I don't mind that. I like that. And then that sent me on a reverie of why I find women in that outfit very sexually appealing.
Well, your boiler was always broken as a child.
And it was, I haven't thought about this in 25 years. There's a scene. There's a scene in a Bond movie. It's The Living Daylights.
Uh-huh.
Okay. It's Timothy Dalton era. So I would have seen this when I was 14 or something.
Yeah.
The Living Daylights. And the opening of that movie, it's a very confusing movie. But the beginning of The Living Daylights, Timothy Dalton is trying to get out a Russian double agent. And he's using a big giant gas pipeline.
Oh, I'm looking at a picture of her now.
Right.
Rosika Miklos.
And so he's got to distract this Russian worker guy, schlub, from looking somewhere. And he's going to sneak in the double agent into this pipe. And he's got to distract someone. And he's got a busty Russian double agent. Another double agent.
Rosika Miklos.
Who's going to be the distraction.
Yeah. She's actually Czechoslovakian.
So she's wearing this zip boiler suit. And she goes into this room to distract this bespeckled Russian schlub.
Yeah.
Whose one job is to look at these cameras. What she does is she's got her hair tied up because obviously she's a very uptight Russian, and she undoes her hair, and the hair just blossoms, it all willows down,
right? Yeah.
And then she unzips the top of her boiler suit, and she's got very, very large breasts.
Yeah, of course.
And what she proceeds to do is she puts this man's head just to nuzzle in her cleavage. Nothing else.
No,
that's it. That's all she does. He just nuzzles in the cleavage.
Rosika leaves to distract the supervisor by smothering the man in her cleavage. You're right.
That's right. Nothing else happens. He's in there. And then meanwhile, the camera holds on this scene of this kind of poor man smothering in her cleavage. I think he's enjoying it, obviously.
Sure.
And meanwhile, Dalton gets out the double agent. At some point,
Dalton successfully launches the pig.
At some point, the busty, boiler suited lady pulls the schlub's head out of her bosom.
Yeah.
And then looks disdainfully and kind of like, I think she slaps him.
She says, "What kind of girl do you think I am?"
Right. And she stomps off. Now, this is a key sex memory for me.
I was going to say, this also explain why you love being so frustrated all the time.
What I don't understand is, what has this guy... He hasn't got anything out of this.
No.
But also, what have I got out of this? I was very kind of confused as a young teen watching this. Like, it's supposed to be sexy. Is it? It's not... there's the power. This schlub has no power at all.
No.
And yet he's getting to kind of billow in amongst this cleavage.
Well, I don't want to overanalyze this for you, of course.
no, but given, forbid,
given that it's a given that it's an early sex memory for you, presumably at a time where, you know, imprinting can happen around that age.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's obviously had a bit of an impact. But I do just want to point out that the specificity involved here, it's not just any sort of sexualized moment. It is a woman sort of brings the head of the man to nuzzle amongst the cleavage. Now, there are some obviously the stark imagery there is non-sexual, isn't it? It's of breastfeeding. It's of the sort of maternal relationship. And I wonder whether... that's one of the reasons that it might have been confusing for you to see it as a child in a sort of exciting and confusing way.
I knew that you'd probably go to breastfeeding, but it's not it's not a breastfeeding type sex image.
Well, the angle isn't, but it,
the
is,
angle's
it, it, it is
anti.
About the woman is in charge of bringing the man's head to her to her bosom.
Yeah,
I mean, in the motherly way that a mother would bring a baby to the teat. I mean, it's like
no, that's not how mothers. Yeah, no, but lest we forget, though, the boiler suit. It's all about the boiler suit.
Right, yeah.
And it's the zip. It's the zip.
And did you tell your wife this?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what did she say?
I think she just tuned out as soon as I started talking about the living daylights.
Yeah. She's, oh, God.
Just like everyone
there he goes.
Else.
He's talking about Rosika Miklos again, the fictional pipeline technician. Employed at the Soviet Trans-Siberian Pipeline and secretly an intelligence operative working for the British Secret Service. Oh, he won't stop talking about Rosika Miklos. Hey, do you want to play the... it's me, I'm Kevin Bacon, the Kevin Bacon game?
Yeah, man, let's play it quick.
Okay.
Let's play it quick.
Well, listen.
I'm going to play it quick.
Remember, we've got the two-minute timer. And today it's not a controversial one. It's not a controversial one. So it's going to be the 2 minute. Last week we talked about having more time if it was hard. This isn't hard. Okay. So I'm giving you a 2 minute timer.
The 2 minute timer thing.
You said let's play it quick.
Yeah. But also I feel like I want the timer to begin after I've done a minute of me sharing my knowledge.
But that would be a 3 minute timer.
No, because that's a different thing, because I'm not connecting in that time. I'm talking about films, I'm expressing my knowledge, I'm not making connections.
Okay, how about this then, right? We'll do, I'll explain the game and give you the names, and then I'll pop a 1 minute timer on for you to talk through, and then I'll stop you, and then I'll pop a 2 minute timer on for you to play the game.
Love.
Yeah?
Correct.
You like that?
I like that, yeah. I think that's going to be, everyone's going to love that.
Okay, well, here's how the game works, okay? I'm going to give Adam the names of two actors, and Adam's job is to find connections between these actors through films. So say, for example, it's actor A to actor B. Adam will say, actor A is in a film with this person, who's in a film with this person, who's in a film with actor C. And the number of films used is Adam's Bacon number.
Actor B, mate. Why have you said actor C?
I don't know. Whatever, it doesn't
That's
matter.
The shittiest
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. If you haven't heard of the fucking 6 degrees
Hold
of Kevin
let me just
Bacon
pop a,
game,
let me just pop a complaining timer on for you, and then you've got 10 seconds to complain. Oh, you finished already. Excellent. Great. Okay. Now, listen, Adam
Joe
doesn't have to get it. Adam doesn't have to get it in the shortest possible number of moves. I will tell you later what that is. All Adam has to do is beat me, okay? But the trick is he doesn't know how many moves I've done it in, so he's got to try and get it as short as he can. Now, the two actors for today, Adam, and I'm about to start your 1 minute timer to tell me about your knowledge, okay?
Yeah.
Are Dustin Hoffman, because we've been talking about a lot of women, so let's get some guys in here. Dustin
Hoffers.
Hoffers. And Bale, okay? Because because of course Christian Bale is in the 1994 version of Little Women. And now I've started your 1 minute timer to tell us about your knowledge.
Wow, Christian Bale in Hoffers. I mean, Dustin Hoffman. You know, you want to go straight to Hook because Hook gives you Spielberg.
Yeah.
Is it only starring? I can't go via director because I could go.
You can't go via director. It's actors only.
Hoffman was in Hook. Spielberg directed Hook.
Yeah.
Spielberg directed Empire.
Sounds like you're making connections in the bit where you explain your knowledge. I don't know if that's what you said you were going to do.
No. It's a lovely, I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. Hoffman.
What knowledge?
He's been in so many things.
It's incredible knowledge.
Oh, God.
45 seconds of your knowledge time's gone already, by the way.
Well, everyone knows what Christian Bale's in, so I'm just thinking of Hoffman, mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
Kramer versus Kramer.
Sure.
Tootsie.
Yeah.
You know.
And three, two, one. There's your time. Restarting, and your 2 minute timer to play the game. It begins now.
Okay, so I'm doing this in silence now.
Right, yeah.
The problem is I'm overwhelmed and blinded by choice. And in 2 minutes, that's a huge problem.
Uh-huh.
I just want everyone to know that that's what my problem is. It's being blinded by choice. It's like I'm a Russian schlub sat in a room and a busty woman in a boiler suit has come in and unzipped and shoved my face in her bosoms, and but one bosom is Dustin Hoffman and the other one is Christian Bale.
Sure.
And I don't know where to look.
Yeah.
I genuinely don't know where to look.
Well, you've got 40 seconds left.
I'm not responding to this way of doing it. It's not fun at all.
I know, you're wilting, and that's fine. We've found your pressure point. Perhaps we've realised that this kind of pressure doesn't bring the best out of you. What would bring the best out of you?
Nothing, just like a loosey-goosey chat of stuff. Okay, well, anyway, I'll get there. I'll do it live when you say time's up. Once I've just thought of films.
Time's up.
Great.
Why don't you just take a longer route? Why don't you just go? I think the thing is, what the game should either be this, right? Either one of two things, right? Because for listeners, this has been heavily edited, but this has now been going on for over 10 minutes, right? The 2 minute thing doesn't work, right? So either what we should do is keep the 2 minute thing, enforce that as the timer. Either you fail and you can't do it, or once you reach that 2 minutes, you just have to say actors and say a film and then say another actor. You have to keep going.
Yeah.
You have to stick to the route as you build it.
I like that. Okay, yeah.
Until you get there. And that's as long as it is. Or okay. I give it to you half an hour before we start recording and I give you a bit of time to think about it.
Those are all fun options. Okay, listen. Okay, we'll do the long. I think the long route's the funnest one. Watch me sweat.
Because you got all the way to Philip Seymour Hoffman, and then I'm like, yeah, just keep going. See how many it takes, but keep going. So that's where you're starting from, okay? You went from Dustin Hoffman through Rain Man to Tom Cruise. Then you got to Philip Seymour Hoffman with Mission Impossible 3. That's where you are now. You've said two
that's
films.
Where I am now.
Now you just keep rolling, okay?
Yeah, and then also I think the additional rule is, and this is a chess rule, touch a piece.
Yep.
Move a piece.
Exactly, exactly.
Where as soon as I touch a piece, I've touched Seymour Hoffman.
Exactly. But you have to do it. You can't sit there quietly thinking about it.
No,
just
no,
go.
I'm now on it now.
Just go.
No, but I just wanted to tell that story.
I love it.
Sad I've been.
No, I know. I'm sad for you. It was a moving story. But now you're at Philip Seymour Hoffman. What's the first film you can think of that he's in?
No, it's not that. I'll 10 seconds, I'm going to move this piece towards Christian Bale.
Okay, go.
I'm going to move this. Don't say go.
No,
like
but this
that.
Is just you the can't. Same as it was before. Otherwise, it's like it's that's what you were doing before. You keep trying to buy yourself time. Just go. See what happens.
It's just a way for me to show off how many films I know.
Exactly. You've seen so many films. The more in this list, the more impressive, I'd say.
Oh, mate, you have just said the magic words. Okay, Philip Seymour Hoffman was in Dead Poets. No, he was in Scent of a Woman.
Yes, he was.
With, who am I going to touch a piece, move a piece? Al Pacino.
Al Pacino, okay. Touch a piece, move a piece.
Al Pacino, touch a piece, move a piece. Yep. Oh, does he get me somewhere? Where he's in so many movies. Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yes, that's right.
He was in Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah, with?
With, which of those guys do I want to pick? Kevin Spacey?
Kevin Spacey, yeah.
Fuck's sake.
Okay, now, yeah, great. Spacey to Bale, Spacey to Bale.
Spacey to Bale, Spacey to Bale. LA Confidential.
LA Confidential, okay, yeah, great.
Which gives me Rusty Crowe.
Uh-huh.
And Rusty Crowe is in Law, Love and Thunder.
Yeah.
With Christian Bale.
There you go. That's mate, not bad. That's six. That's not bad.
That's not bad. That's a really fun route.
That's a really fun route.
It's a stupid route.
No, but it's a fun route.
Hey, I'm fun and I don't care.
I mean you do care.
Yeah, I care so much.
You care. Yeah,
I really want to hear your route. I can't wait to hear your route.
Well, my hook. Unfortunately, you haven't beaten me. My route is three. I didn't use Hook. I used Kramer versus Kramer.
Oh,
so I took Dustin Hoffman. I went through Kramer versus Kramer to Meryl, who of course is in Devil Wears Prada with Anne Hathaway, who's in The Dark Knight Rises with Christian Bale.
Oh, that's clean.
I think that's the canon route. Of big movie route. I did look on Oracle of Bacon. I think there's a number of different two options here. Here's the first of them. Christian Bale's in 1994's Little Women with Kirsten Dunst, who's in Wag the Dog with Dustin Hoffman. So that's two.
I've seen Wag the Dog. She's a kind of a minor role. That's annoying.
Christian Bale's in Captain Corelli's Mandolin with John Hurt, who's in Perfume, The Story of a Murderer with Dustin Hoffman.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Niche, like that. That's a good one. I like these. These are good tours.
Christian Bale's in Henry V with Judi Dench, who's in Roald Dahl's SEO Trot with Dustin Hoffman.
That went straight to telly.
Yeah.
No, boo.
How about this? Christian Bale's in Citizen Steve with Robin Williams, who's in, I guess he's in Hook with Dustin Hoffman, right?
Yeah.
So there you could have done that with the two.
Citizen Steve.
Citizen
no.
Citizen Steve.
Not, that's not a canon answer.
What about this one? You'll like this one. Christian Bale is in The Prestige with who? Scarlett Johansson, who's in Chef with Dustin Hoffman.
He barely appears in... Does he appear in Chef as what?
I don't know.
I do like that one. Can I tell you one of the main thing... that I really loved about watching Little Women this time.
Only if when you're done I can tell you the things I hate about it.
Perfect.
Great. Go ahead.
It made me yearn for the kind of relationships that women and sisters have with each other. The way that the...
Intimacy.
The intimacy, the joy that the sisters and the mum have together, the way they kind of fall into each other and hold each other in such...
They collapse around mommy's feet, don't they? And listen to daddy's letters.
It's fantastic. And I watched the same scene. I tried to rewatch the Winona Ryder version. I saw the same scene directed two ways. And in the Winona Ryder version, it's just very staid and... I don't know, flat. And then Gerwig has got so much vibrancy in this film. She brings such life to like an oldie worldy book. I was like watching it, just thinking, oh, this film is about the economic disparity that women have and how unfair their treatment is. And at the same time, Gerwig has, she shoots their lives with so much joy and they have so much happiness in spite of all that. And in contrast, the men she shoots the men, like Laurie and the old grumpy Chris Cooper, looking on. They're all alone, and they want to be part of this loving unit, but they're just sort of passers-by. I just thought it was really fantastic, and I just wanted, it just made me think, like, why, we don't see that enough in cinema. There's not enough celebration of it, and also it made me sad that just, you know, brothers and men, we don't really have that just generally. We can't just drape into each other.
Well, we could, but like, can you imagine if next time we hang out, we just sort of drape on each other?
It's too late. We're broken.
I couldn't do it. I couldn't drape on you.
We don't express need or what's the word? We don't express, that's not how we...
We don't ask for intimacy from men.
No, but then, I wouldn't think, oh, Joe really is giving me something here. By you draping on me, I wouldn't receive that as like, oh, Joe really rates me as a human being and really cares about me. I'd think, what would I think? I'd think...
You'd think, get off me. I'm uncomfortable. You know?
Yeah.
That's what I'd think. If you draped on me, I'd think like, what?
Don't. But human touch is so, obviously, so important.
Mm-hmm.
So why, how have we got to this point where we're broken off from it?
We're getting it from women. That's the thing. We expect it all from women.
Right. So why can't we get it? Whenever people make fun of male sports about masculine sports like rugby and American football.
Slapping each other on the ass after a play, that sort of thing.
Right. And so the jibes are always... They kind of almost seem, is it, they kind of feel kind of homophobic. Like they're talking about these very straight men who are secretly gay. This is the gayest sport ever, actually, because, and this is not me saying that.
No.
That's what they're saying about these very straight, masculine, horrible guys. Oh, secretly, they really want to touch other men. And it's like, yeah. Not secretly, they do really want to touch other men,
yeah,
and have kind of closeness and touch.
And through the camaraderie of sports, it's allowed, isn't it? If it's a bit rough and tumble and slap on the back and whatever.
But then the joke is always to sexualize it.
Yeah, yeah.
To then diminish that kind of that thing. I mean, those men, I you kind of want to diminish them anyway because they seem like bellends. But that's what stops a lot of men, I guess, maybe getting into that kind of horseplay in the first place, because the worst thing you could, when I was growing up, maybe when you were growing up as well, the worst thing that you could be called was gay.
Yeah. But it is funny to think that even, like, you and I are sat 15, 20 miles apart right now in different houses, right? In 2025, and we're having this conversation. But if I ask you to think about draping on me next time we see each other, you're going to feel uncomfortable even though we can't even touch each other right now. But how do you feel when I say that?
I don't feel uncomfortable because we are...
Think about it. Think about lying over me. Like, we're on the couch. Think about when we were watching Avengers Endgame together, right? We're on the couch in Ireland. You lean on me a bit. You rest your head on my chest.
Yeah. No, I kept wanting to do that and reach out, but I just knew.
Gay, gay, gay.
I am a golden god. I am a golden god.
Hey, Russell. Go.
I can't see how anyone could have any issue with any of it.
I've got some. I've got issues. Come to me. Pick me.
Oh, hang on a sec. I think there's someone down in the front. Yes, you, sir. Have you got some problems with the movie Little Women, directed by Greta Gerwig from 2019?
Yes, I do. All of the actors are female, and I don't enjoy watching women in cinema.
Boo.
Boo.
No, so, you more serious-looking man, you got some actual caveats, have you?
I do. I just want to say, I know I'm sat next to that man that was just talking, but we didn't come together. I'm not with him. Well, I've got things I think are bad about the film.
Yeah, hit me.
There are three things that I think are bad about this film. And unfortunately, the first one is an actor. Do I need to say more?
Meryl Streep?
Oh, come on. Meryl Streep's fantastic. Meryl Streep embodies Aunt March. Meryl Streep is magnificent as Aunt March. No, the actor I'm referring to, of course, is Emma Watson.
Oh, yeah.
As Meg March.
Yeah, she stinks.
She stinks. She stinks. It's a real shame. I feel very sorry for her because she does stink. Also, she's surrounded by people who really don't stink in their roles. And it's just a real shame because Emma Watson, I think she seems like a very pleasant person. And I think in certain roles, she's absolutely fine. And in one or two, like in Perks of Being a Wallflower, I think she's great in that film. In this film, she's got a bit of a tendency to sort of overplay it a bit like she learned how to act on stage. And then is in a film. But I know that's not true. So it's confusing for me.
I mean, this film is packaged on names. Gerwig's going to the studio and she's saying, I want to make Little Women. And the male studio head he's gone, oh, what? Oh, God, shut up. This is so boring. What have you done, Gerwig? Oh, You've made Lady Bird. Oh, well done, Gerwig. You've made Lady Bird. Oh, that's done some okay business. You want how much money? I don't know. We haven't done the box office game yet. How much money do you want? What? For a period piece? Give me names, Gerwig. Give me names. Yeah. And these names better equate to box office.
Mm-hmm.
And Watson's name is unfortunately going to be in that mix.
It's the main name. It's the name that at the time people were saying, oh, it's the Emma Watson film. Like, that's honestly, that's what it is.
Who are these people?
People who hadn't seen Little Women before. The bulk of the audience, if you asked everyone in the world which one of these actors they knew better, they would all, yeah. the vast majority would tell you Emma Watson. Like, this is an Emma Watson film, whether she's the lead or not.
They would say Hermione's in it.
Yeah, of
course. They wouldn't say Emma Watson's in it.
They'd say Hermione's in it. And great. It's a real shame.
It's a real shame.
Do you know what? It might have been fine, but I have to tell you that Florence Pugh as Amy is absolutely incredible in this film. And what she does is the definition of breathing new life into a character. Amy March is a shit character. Amy March is a rubbish, little annoying little sister character who serves to piss off Joe and to steal the boyfriend. And, you know, like in all of the other renditions that I've seen, she's just annoying and like two-dimensional and straightforwardly sort of antagonistic, right? Florence Pugh shows up with obviously the assistance of Greta Gerwig and absolutely steals the film. She breathes new life into the character. That's what the people who invented that saying meant. It's like this Florence Pugh performance. And unfortunately, alongside that, Emma Watson sucks the air out of Meg March in a way that makes a boring character so much more bland. And I know that's horrible, and I couldn't do it. I can't do it anywhere near as good as she can. And it's very judgmental for me to say that. And I know if, you know, she ever listened to that, there's no excuse for me saying it, except it's on my mind. And you know, I shouldn't say it, but it's true. And it's a shame because she happens to be in this particular project alongside one or two people doing absolutely extraordinary things with their acting performances, and she can't do it. And she also happens to be stepping into the shoes of Emma Stone, who was lined up and signed up to play Meg March in this role before she had a conflict.
Joking?
No, Emma Stone was signed up to do it, and then she had to go and do The Favourite instead, and there was a scheduling conflict. So Emma Watson stepped in. Emma Stone was the name that they were going to hang the thing around.
Fuck.
And so they need someone of like the same or better caliber.
Oh, man.
And so not only is she bad in the film, but also she steps into the role of an actor who I don't know. I don't think Emma Stone would have been great in the movie, but I think she would have been better than Emma Watson.
I think you're fine. She would. Hello. Yes, I'm calling the past. I'm looking in the past. I'm going, yes, Emma Stone's great in this movie. Yeah, Emma Stone is fucking great in this movie.
Well, she would at the very least, she has the opportunity to breathe new life into the role in the same way that Florence Pugh does.
Of course she does. Yeah. You've got Pugh breathing new life.
Yeah.
Stone, mate. Stone was born to breathe new life into shit like this.
Sure, yeah.
Oh, that
also, she would actually look older and more, you know, Saoirse Ronan doesn't look old, but she just looks so wise that it's, in some scenes, it's really funny to imagine that Emma Watson is playing the older sister. It just doesn't, yeah, it just doesn't look right at all.
Doesn't look right. Stone would blatantly, this is the great what ifs. I'm going to call it right now. The great what ifs of cinema. Stanley Kubrick's Napoleon, Emma Stone's Meg March. That's, I'm not even joking. It would have
been. I think it could have been. Oh, and can you imagine how gutting that is also if you're Greta Gerwig and you've got, like, she signed up, you know, she's ready to come. And then you're going like, oh, fuck, she's off to go and do, I mean, yeah, sure, she's going to win an Oscar or something. Does she win an Oscar for The Favourite? Can't remember. But no,
she doesn't.
But, you know, she's off to do a big movie.
She bags old Lanthimos, and then she's in Lanthimos's pocket for the next fucking million years.
And then she wins an Oscar.
Doing Lanthimos movies, Stone. I'm sick of it. I don't care.
Get in a Gerwig.
Get in a Gerwig. Gerwig is full of joy.
I'd much rather you'll be in here.
I'd much rather you did a Gerwig than start like dreary Lanthimos. No, Gerwig is full of joy and hope. And Lanthimos is just dreary drivel. Oh, here you are. You're a fucking sex robot. Fuck off.
Do you want bad thing number two?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Marmy needs to stop whispering everywhere. God damn it. I love Marmy. Laura Dern as much as the next person, but Marmy needs to stop whispering everywhere. I know the point of the character is that she's slightly smarmy, ever so slightly smug, and she's got all this restrained anger and she's supposed to be, you know, embodying that. I just... that there's something about the way that Laura Dern does Everything's Great that makes me want to crawl into my skin and just stop whispering. It's so annoying.
Third?
This one is not as bad because I understand why it has to be the case based on the whole history that we've discussed already. But the German professor is just not in the film enough. He's just in two scenes, really. And the first one is one at the beginning and then the other one's the one at the end. And I sort of just don't like it. And I just think he could have been in one more scene. You know,
he got lost in the edit.
He got lost in the edit.
They would have shot. Listen, that screenplay.
Sure.
Mate.
Apparently they shot more of Meg March as well, and that got a bit lost in the edit as well. You know,
what, old Hermione hit the cutting room floor? Oh, I bought some fabric. Oh, girl, get thee to hide, mother.
Tell you what, mate. Chris Cooper and Meryl Streep are both fucking excellent in this film. Excellent.
What's it? Get the old band back together from Adaptation.
Yeah, big time.
It's like, oh, come on. These guys belong together. Chris Cooper.
Yeah.
More Chris Cooper. More men. There needs to be more men in this movie.
Get more men in this film. What about the March Brothers, huh? Let's do Little Men. I think Little Men is already, it's like the third book or something, isn't it?
You little know? Boys, I don't know.
Little Boys, we're Little Men. Hey, let's play the box office game.
Can we?
I'd love to. I'd absolutely love to.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think they're spending on this Little Women? Now, I'll tell you, it was released, of course, you know already, in December 2019, just ahead of the old COVID times. Brackets estimated.
Well, listen, costumes, all those stupid dresses that they wear.
Christ, production design galore.
It's going to cost a pretty penny. Gerwig. She's arrived on the scene. She said, I want to make a movie about women. The studio is going to be all a quiver. I'm like, oh God, if we don't support female movie makers, they're going to come after us as well. We don't want to be on the receiving end of that. We better get
like
some money.
I like this idea, though. Like, we've got to make a film about women. What can we do? Tell you what, let's remake the most famous one that's been made already. Four times, yeah. I don't care what your wife says, four times, and we'll know we'll be a smash hit with all the best actors in it.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good idea. And was it? Was it a smash hit?
It's a great hedge. So I reckon they're going to give her 60 mil?
They don't. They give her 40 mil.
Oh, okay. I think Greta Gerwig deserved $60 million for this movie, and I don't care who knows it.
We're going to find out whether she deserved $60 million for the movie or not as we move forwards. Firstly, into opening weekend US and Canada. Now, we did say December 29th, 2019. What do you think a movie like this is taking on its opening weekend?
Well, it's taking plenty. Everyone wants to go and see a warm-hearted Hermione starring flick. Like this. 16 mil?
Wow. It racks in 16.7 mil.
Oh, that is... That's a bullseye.
Sure. Well, yeah.
Hang on a sec. Mm-hmm. Hang on. Mm-hmm. Is that a bullseye or are you going to say I needed to say 0.7? Is that a bullseye? Is that a bullseye or are you going to say sure? Is that a bullseye? Hang on. Is that a bullseye?
It's
Joe?
A bullseye. Oh. And it's some turnaround from the game we were playing earlier. So well done. Well done.
What game were we playing earlier?
The one that took a long time. Now, yeah, listen, gross worldwide, moving swiftly on from your bullseye. Gross worldwide, how much does this movie take in its gross, in its worldwide gross?
Gross worldwide. It's a toughie.
It's
did very well. Very warmly received. Mm. The world needed this movie.
Mm.
It did pretty well at the Oscarinos, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall if it won anything, but it was certainly nommed.
Well, I can tell you, it won one Oscar. Which one do you think it was?
I think it...
I'm going to guess production design.
I'm going to guess costume design. I think it should have got best screenplay. Who's it up against?
It was the winner in costume design. Yeah,
but I just
Jacqueline
said, I just,
Duran won that one.
I think that's so. What's it up against?
So it was nominated for Best Motion Picture of the Year. It was nominated for Best Performance in a Actress in a Leading Role. So Saoirse Ronan.
No.
It was nominated for Best Performance Actress in a Supporting Role for Florence Pugh. And then you want to know what the screenplay it was up against?
Was it up for screenplay?
It was up for screenplay. So in the best adapted screenplay category, it was up against The Irishman,
better.
The Two Popes,
better.
Joker,
better.
And the winner was Jojo Rabbit.
Oh my God, that is absolutely
Taika Waititi.
Nonsensical. Robbed, man.
Yeah.
Robbed.
Yeah. Well, she wasn't nominated for director either. And in her stead was Bong Joon-ho, who won for Parasite.
Yeah, fair dues.
Todd Phillips was nominated for Joker.
Nonsense.
Martin Scorsese was nominated for The Irishman.
No.
Martin Quentin Tarantino was nominated for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Sam Mendes' Nuts was nominated for 1917.
That is insane. 1917 is an absolute dogshit film.
I would say 1917 and The Irishman do not deserve to be in that list. I don't like Joker, but I know that people think it's a good movie.
But there's no way that that deserves to be in that list.
I don't think so. I mean, I think, retrospectively now, there's absolutely no reason why Greta Gerwig shouldn't be here. What she does creatively in the film is far more interesting than... I think Bong Joon-ho probably deserves to win it for Parasite, but she should be a second in this year.
Yeah, she should be right up there.
Yeah.
Nonsense.
It's almost as though there's sexism.
I've heard that. So what are we on? What are we talking about? What it took?
Gross worldwide. Global. Yeah, global gross worldwide.
I don't think it's still a period piece. It's about women. People are sexist.
My wife and her sisters went to see this on the opening weekend, I think.
But do women go to the cinema then? Is that what you're saying?
I didn't know they did before then, But like, it's a bit like, you know, when the publishers were really surprised that Louisa May Alcott's book even sold originally.
Right.
I think this might be one of those moments where we go like, oh, women do, maybe they will go to the cinema if the film's got women in the title.
Maybe it does boffo and it's on 40. Can it make 200, can it make $200 million? $350?
$332 million.
Wow.
It's a big commercial success. God, Greta Gerwig's piling up the commercial hits, isn't she?
Well, that's where she does it then. And then that's what opens the door to Barbie. And then Barbie, she reinvents the wheel.
Right, yeah. There you go.
Oh, so much chat. Is it? It's time to pick next week's movie.
It is.
I got you on Little Women. Joe, it's your time to try and get me on a movie I forgot, with a movie you forgot. Hit me. You've got five chances, and if you don't hit me in one of these fives, we'll go to the communal listener list.
Okay, great stuff. Fine. Well, I've got a lovely list here. I'm very excited about it. Let me start with the film Cheaper by the Dozen.
No. Just, I would dismiss that as just dog shit.
Fine, but...
It's not a...
You can veto it, but I want you to tell me if it's a Forget You Forgot.
No, it's not a Forget You Forgot.
So you think about that film, do you?
No.
Just admit that you've seen it and you haven't thought about it for years, but you don't want to do it.
I'm not going to admit that.
No, come on. That's bad faith if you don't admit that.
No, because I think I've maybe watched 30 minutes of it. I don't think I would say I've seen it. Or engage with it because
fine. I think that's a tiny bit dishonourable.
What? But I haven't watched it really properly.
Okay. Well,
I just think
you would have just said that at the beginning if that was definitely the case.
No, I just don't think it counts. I don't consider that like if you.
It's a good standard family comedy film. It's a perfectly fine film. That's a very. It's okay if you want to veto it.
I'm not vetoing it. I don't.
You're saying you haven't seen it.
I haven't forgot. I forgot it because it was so shit. I haven't forgot. I forgot it because it was so shit. That's my criteria.
Sure. Okay.
Like if you said to me, Big Daddy, I'd go, no.
If you said to me, Big Daddy, you could get me because I forgot that film.
I'd say, drape over me.
Okay, how about...
I can't believe you wanted to do, you sound so hurt.
It's a good film. Do you know what? It's a good film and I'm disrespected. I'm disrespected by you right now.
Okay. Well,
I feel disrespect. And you know, at least one person listening also thinks that's a good film and they know that you've seen it and you've forgotten it. You could have just said veto. Right, how about this instead?
I've effectively said veto by going, it's too shit to consider.
David Copperfield with Dev Patel.
No.
What? Why?
Because I've not forgot it.
It's a fucking great film.
I hated it. I hated love that film.
It's such
it was
a good
so
movie.
Badly done. So bad.
Good. You won't find Adam and I having this chalk and cheese and opinion about another film, by the way. Normally, one of us can see the sort of point of view of the other. In this instance, the Dev Patel, David Copperfield, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And you thought it was... terrible.
You're blinded by Dev Patel. He's superb in it.
Very happy to be blinded by Dev Patel. Loved being blinded by Dev Patel.
Shit film. Absolute shit.
Great movie. Okay, that was two. Number three.
He's thinking.
The thing is, you're going to say no to this for the same reason that you said no.
You never know.
You said no to the first one.
You never know.
Shanghai Nights.
If you say Shanghai Noon, you've got a winner.
Is that the first one?
Yeah.
That's the one I mean. Shanghai Noon with Owen Wilson and Jackie Chan.
Yes, mate. Now you've found your pants and you've pulled them up. This is how you play.
Okay.
That's phenomenal.
So we're doing
that
Shanghai
Noon. That is a phenomenal suggestion.
Great. Excellent.
I saw that in the cinema.